This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Artistic expression is a uniquely human way to share feelings and insights. Art can help us understand each other and sometimes help promote change. Musician Tom Brousseau created and hosts the Great American Folk Show. In Episode 6, airing on this station on Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, poets, musicians, and even a leather worker explore ideas of race, loneliness, and life before the Internet. Brousseau spoke with our Ashley Thornburg.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me back on Main Street.
So you've been at this half a year now, and now from my perspective, it's gone by really fast. How about for you?
Yeah, it's gone by pretty quickly, too. You know, to sit down and do these episodes, to write for them and kind of get the right booking and all that stuff, it seems to go by pretty slowly, but then here we are, a half year into it, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, so much has changed, and so much has progressed, and you know, we just all keep on looking forward to the next episode.
It reminds me of a sentiment from a favorite poem in French, and I don't have this translation exact, but it's something like, the days pass slowly and the years fly by.
That is so true. Yeah, so I was told the same thing when my little child was born, that yep. The days would go by very slowly, but the years would go by so fast. And that's so true.
Yeah. I'll never understand that warp in the space-time continuum, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. it's a fun place to explore anyway.
Yeah. You got that right.
Speaking of exploration, how do you characterize what you are exploring in Episode 6 of The Great American Folk Show?
So Episode 6 and I think Episode 5 are really getting close to the original design of the program, which is to present the best slice of the great United States. And Episode 6 will feature, I think, more folk artists and writers and poets than we have on any of the previous episodes. But then there's a lot of musicians on, so it's really jam-packed. There's a lot of variety with Episode 6, and I think we pulled it off pretty well. The guests did an amazing job.
I was really struck in Episode 6 by the poet that you have, Bridget Bianca. And this builds off of what you were talking about in Episode 5, which for anybody who hasn't heard it, you can go on to prairiepublic.org and listen to all of the episodes. But especially in Episode 5, it opens, I believe, with a monologue that is addressing racism. And it's from the perspective of a white person who deals with a racist bandmate. And now in Episode 6, you have this poet, Bridget Bianca, and it is a heart-wrenching plea from a black woman and a black mother about mm-hmm. all of the things that they have to tell their kids that the white people don't. I just want to know your reaction when you first heard a poem that has something as simple but with as profound of complications and implications of don't take your hands out of your pockets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bridget Bianca, she's been a poet for a long time. And when I approached her, I'd asked her if she would be interested in contributing to the show. And she didn't know if she had the appropriate material. I mean, she was concerned, you know, that this might not be the right platform. And when she expressed that to me, then I thought, well, I think that she does have the right material for this platform. And so she had sent me a series of it was her brand new collection of poetry, Be Trouble. And I read through it all and was touched very deeply. And this one just really stood out to me when I read it. So to say, you know, Bridget, would you read this? Her performance of the piece is, I mean, the poem itself is one thing. It's just an amazing poem, mm-hmm. but her actual performance of it is really, it's very touching, and it's immediate and very powerful too. Very lucky to have Bridget Bianca on the program.
Yeah, you can hear it in her tone of voice, that mm-hmm. that constant worry that a mother always has, and especially in the world we're living in today.
It's unceasing. There's not, she doesn't, you know, and the poem is that way too. It's almost like there's no breaths. And, but to hear her when she, as she performs it is people will hear it when they tune in to the show on this coming Sunday.
Yeah.
They'll hear where she does take those pauses and how she expands, how the poem expands because of that. So it's a performance piece. It's, mm-hmm. you know, that's another aspect of it. And it's, you know, not all poets are the ones to read their poems in a way. So to hear Bridget, you know, read her poem is very effective.
And then you have North Dakota's own Chuck Suki, very well known across the state as one of many talented Sukis. And he has a very interesting story to a song that he writes, also dealing with race relations. But I think it's fair to say from a very different approach, because as much as we are still living in a world that's very categorized by race, we talk about it in terms of black and white. And there are a lot more groups than that, in particular in North Dakota, with a very strong indigenous background that has largely been treated as forgotten, as an erased people. And he talks about a man he meets and a lesson that he's taught that, of course, he's way too young to understand mm-hmm. at the time of just the entire concept of wanting to be recognized as a person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The great Chuck Suki, who is from the Mandan area, North Dakota. He's a working farmer. So, you know, I've known of him for a long time. Read about him, listened to his music for a long time, but you know, I kind of forget that music, in a way, is I would say fueled mm-hmm. by his passion, which is farming and working the land. And you know, with that, because I mean, I think that one becomes a poet. You know, the cowboys out there who are working, they naturally are in touch with the elements, and because of that they kind of turn into poets. And so getting back to Chuck, he has a wisdom about him mm. And have him come on the show and sing a song is one thing, but to have him set that song up like he did with Kenny Rainbow is pretty special. And he's so incredibly humble as he does it, and he's a master storyteller, that guy, you know?
Well, yeah, I appreciate the almost, I want to say, multidimensionality. I mean, I realize it's in both cases, it's both audio of the storytelling and then the mm-hmm. song performance. But to hear the process of the songwriting, for mm-hmm. me anyway, makes the song so much more relatable. And otherwise, you know, I'm just one of those classic, I just sing the words without really knowing what they mean. So
mm-hmm. yeah, his story, Kenny Rainbow, is it was that song was in the making for many years. So he was a young man when he, you know, met this individual, Kenny Rainbow, and it took him it took him many, many years to realize what that meeting, what it meant to him to meet Kenny Rainbow, for him to write that song. Mm. You know, it was a grain of sand back then. and it turned into a pearl. Only time can bring those things.
Yeah, I imagine many a song is written like that. Mm. We're visiting with Tom Brosseau. He is the creator and host of The Great American Folk Show. You can listen to episode 6 this coming Sunday at 5 o'clock Central right here on Prairie Public. And you can catch all previous episodes at prairiepublic.org. And Tom, I love that there is also a guy who makes a zine, you know, kind of like a magazine, but more like a pamphlet or flyer, and anywhere from one page to 10 pages. It might be free, it might be $10, what have you. And I was really struck by a sentence that he said in there, that zines were really big in particular before the internet was a thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, being of that sort of micro generation that started life analog and whose whole adult life has been digital, it was still sort of like, oh yeah, I kind of forgot about that time before the internet was a thing.
Yeah, right. Where we did things like this, we had these hobbies and these passions. Yeah, Jonas Cannon from Chicago, Illinois, just a really interesting guy. And you know, there's another poet on the program, Gino Sky, who is a lot like Jonas Cannon in a way that he had a mimeograph poetry magazine.
Wow.
Which is very much like, it's almost like the precursor of the zine. That part of his biography, of Gino Sky's biography, I think I'll touch on in episode 7. But that there's this hope, and there's this belief, and that there's this need and want to reach an audience with, you know, with an art, with a folk art. And you know, I think that that's the important part of any of this, is that we do have hope, and we do have that want and that need and passion to keep on with it, you know, regardless of being able to see the numbers, regardless of, you know, of the internet, that we're still keeping up with these things, you know.
Yeah. Well, I love too that you just said, you know, you want to touch people with a folk art, because you have quite the specialist on the show too, a banjo and guitar strap designer. How'd you find her?
I don't know. I mean, so much a part of what I do for the program is just kind of keeping an eye on the internet and social media. And thankfully, there are so many people doing so many creative things that, you know, anytime it seems like I get on social media, I'm seeing people who represent so many different art forms. So I think I had just, there was a banjo player somewhere, and he had this incredible strap. And I remember he was an accomplished banjo player, but what stuck out to me most was the strap that he had keeping his banjo on. And I just thought to myself, oh my gosh, I've got to follow this.
That's fantastic.
And it led me to Angelina Elise.
Yeah. Well, I'm on her website as we speak, and it's angelinaelise.com. And you are right. These straps are gorgeous.
They're out of this world. It's like from a dream or something.
Yeah. Did you get yourself one?
No, I didn't. But one of these days. Let me just tell you. One of these days. Yeah.
You're going to design it? You're going to let her design it?
I'll probably just let her design it. I'll have to give her a few, you know, clues. And but I've already fallen in love with one of them, which I detail on the show about this woman holding on to a crocodile. So maybe she'll make a version of that for me. Who knows?
Well, yeah, I'm intrigued. I want to pull the thread on what you just said. I'll give her some clues. What words would you use to say the kind of strap that your guitar needs?
Mythical, I would say, which she's already got down. and I would say something with the color blue, which is my favorite. And maybe I would point her into the direction of Rosemal, which is you know, the Norwegian or Scandinavian way of painting, and just see what she comes up with.
I really want, I can't wait to see this.
Yeah. I'll get it done and I'll show you.
There is a charming voicemail that you are playing on the show from a woman named Suzanne, and she's a friend of yours, and you guys are kind of playing phone tag here. And in this message, she talks about being a little bit lonely and keeping a guy on the phone who ends up being a wrong number, but she just wants to talk. And I feel like I've done that to my husband a lot of times. So to me, that's just illustrates the power of the human voice, that even someone you don't know, you just want to talk sometimes.
Yeah, you kind of want to hear them talk. And I think in this case, she was wanting to bend somebody's ear for a little bit. And, you know, it seemed to work out for her pretty well. The Suzanne Valley, she's a transplant. So she is now living in, you know, California, but she's from South Dakota. And I can tell that South Dakota, that Great Plains sense, even a little bit of an accent too. So I just kind of feel for this person, and I feel for, you know, I've been there. I've been in that position where you're in California and you're kind of lonely. You don't really know too many people. And, you know, the first person who's willing who comes by, you know, you make them stay an extra 10 minutes or something like that. You know?
Yeah.
I've done that before many times,
actually. I'm pretty sure my first shopping trip after the start of the pandemic, I had a very long conversation with a very patient cashier who didn't shut me up and probably should have. What you got cooking for episode 7?
Well, it's going to be a good one. It's going to be a singer-songwriter by the name of Trey Burt, who's from Sacramento, California. He was, as far as I know, discovered by John Prine and was signed to his record label, Oh Boy Records. So Trey Burt's going to be on the program. His monologue is it's going to be a pretty deep one, and two of his songs are going to be great, great songs from a record of his called Caught It in the Rye. And then, as far as I know, Grant Lee Phillips is going to be on the program too. He's a singer-songwriter, and he was in a band called Grant Lee Buffalo for a number of years before he went out solo. And here's a man who is totally connected to the land in the same way that Chuck Suki is. And he's Americana, back when Americana was just starting out. Absolutely wonderful voice, great, great lyrics. And I'm sure he's going to have a great story to tell too. And then I'm going to revisit a serialization. So Gino Sky, poet Gino Sky, is on episode 6, and I'll have him back for episode 7. And of course, Joe Wiegand will be back, and you know, I think there's going to be one other surprise, but I haven't gotten that confirmation yet, so I'll hold my tongue for a second.
Have you had any trouble getting guests?
No trouble getting guests, just trying to figure out when they can, you know, sit down and send in the materials. Over the summer, it's been difficult for a lot of people because there's a lot of not traveling, but virtual shows happening. And and so, you know, it's just kind of like a waiting game. But fortunately, there's a lot of people who want to be a part of it, and they have a lot to say. And this is, you know, well, you just have to be patient, I guess. Yeah.
In the early days of the pandemic, I did hear from some creatives who kind of welcomed it as a chance to take a break and to reset and to work different creative mm-hmm. muscles. But now, of course, we're several months in and, you know, people like you are making a living performing music live. And even as we are recording this conversation, you are in Oregon, which is being plagued by both wildfires and a pandemic, not to mention certain parts are facing riots still.
Mm-hmm.
How's it going for you and some of your friends who are, you know, are you kind of at this stage of like, okay, I do need to start making a living again?
Yeah. And, you know, feeling like getting out there is just really kind of what it's all about. But, you know, in actuality, we can't let our guard down, and we have to keep our masks on, and we need to be safe, and we need to social distance. So, you know, I know a lot of performers are out there doing some shows here and there, but nothing around crowds. The stuff that I'm doing is I'm doing a virtual show in Baker City, and two little backyard shows along the way. But I'm recording people. I've got a few people that I've recorded for the Great American Folk Show. And I feel like now is a pretty good time to do it.
Yeah. Gather the material now and then you'll have a long time to edit it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'll take my time doing that.
Well, Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Ashley, for having me back on the program.
That was musician Tom Brousseau, who hosts the Great American Folk Show, talking with Ashley Thornburg. Episode 6 airs this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, and you can catch all back episodes at prairiepublic.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Coming up on Main Street, the Republican candidate for North Dakota State Treasurer, Thomas Beadle, and Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The chairman of the legislature's Interim Information Technology Committee says the committee is recommending that the IT department continue with its unification project. IT had earlier recommended that IT functions in state government should be consolidated. The 2019 session passed a measure to do that with some state cabinet-level agencies. Grand Forks Democratic State Representative Corey Mock.
2 years is not enough information to have usable data, but we do agree that the effort should be continued and there should be reasonable attempts to either modify or include new agencies into that pilot project.
Mock says there are some agencies who have shown interest in getting involved with the project, such as the Bank of North Dakota. He says the Department of Public Instruction could also be a part of it, but Mock says other agencies have concerns.
State Water Commission, for example, testified at our earlier meeting in September that they did not want to be unified, that they have specialized services that they wanted to keep in-house and that would not conform well with a unified environment. We also heard from the Attorney General's office that they would not want to be unified because of the sensitivity of their data and a variety of legal requirements.
Mock says under the pilot project, 96 full-time equivalent positions working on information technology were transferred from their home agencies to ITD. Minnesota's top election official is cautioning Minnesotans not to flock to the polls to monitor voting on Election Day. Secretary of State Steve Simon says Minnesota state law has strict limits on poll watchers.
In every polling place, only a maximum of one per major political party is involved, and they must be designated by an official certificate.
Simon says that certificate comes from the political party. He also says any voter challenges have to be based on personal knowledge, not on other factors. And North Dakota gas stations that sell E15 fuel are participating in the third annual Pink at the Pump campaign. 3 cents of every E15 or unleaded 88 gallon sold in August will go toward North Dakota Women's Way for cancer awareness. Dana Weiss is the executive director of North Dakota Ethanol Council.
In every polling place, only a maximum of one.
Unleaded 88 is 15% ethanol and 85% gas. It's better for the environment. It's cleaner burning. So it reduces the amount of carcinogens that get released into the air by using unleaded 88. So yes, this is a great partnership between the ethanol industry and breast cancer awareness.
The North Dakota Ethanol Council and the North Dakota Corn Utilization Council are partnering with 18 gas stations across the state. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Thomas Beadle. He is the Republican candidate for North Dakota Treasurer. Thanks for being with us, Thomas.
Thank you, Doug.
Why are you running for the job?
Well, you know, back in December, the incumbent, Kelly Schmidt, announced that she wasn't going to run for re-election. And so I had a lot of folks approach me looking at this position, say, hey, you should consider it. You know, I've had the opportunity and the honor of representing the citizens of District 27 in South Fargo for the last 10 years. I'm on the Appropriations Committee, so I've got intimate knowledge of our budgets all across the state, which is pertinent to the treasurer's office because the treasurer touches every dollar that flows in and out of the state government. And so having some awareness and some understanding of that budget is crucial, is pretty important. And so they thought that I had a strong skill set and a background that I could bring to the table for this role. So over the holidays, I spoke about it with my family, with my wife, kind of talked about whether this was something we wanted to do. And then in January, decided to take the plunge. You know, we recognize that especially in a time of North Dakota where we have some uncertainty, whether it was, earlier in the year as we were seeing impacts in our oil and agriculture sector where the commodity prices were suppressed. And so we knew that was going to make budgeting and dealing with state government a little tough. And then, since getting into the race, the impacts of COVID on state government, recognizing that, you know, we need to make sure that we're operating as efficiently as possible so that we're not wasting taxpayer dollars. And then also that we're being good stewards of our resources, whether it's through the numerous investments that we have in the State Investment Board or the Land Board, making sure that, you know, we're doing our due diligence and care to best serve our citizens. You know, I thought there was a real opportunity to make an impact here and to really leave North Dakota in a good spot going forward. And so I think I have the skill set and the ability to help. And so that's why I wanted to jump into this race and see if we can be successful in becoming the next treasurer.
Thomas Beadle, running for treasurer of the state of North Dakota. You're also a real estate broker when you're not at the legislature. And I went on your website, thomasbeadle.com, and among the issues you have up there is legacy fund investments. Share that with our listeners because that's one of the roles of the treasurer.
Right. So the treasurer serves on the State Investment Board, one of 11 members overseeing the numerous investments for state funds. You know, the Common Schools Trust Fund and the Legacy Fund are the two big funds in this that this board oversees that have significant impacts on our state. And ever since the Legacy Fund was created, we've been setting aside 10% of the oil extraction tax, or 30%, but 10% of the total production tax going in to create this fund. And so we have about $7 billion set aside in the legacy fund right now, not counting some of the earnings that have been unrealized coming in. And so we have a chance to make a pretty big impact on North Dakota. And one of the things that we've been talking about with the Legacy Fund is how can we make sure that we're investing some of those dollars in state? You know, right now we have numerous fund managers from all across the country managing that investment portfolio. They're investing in, you know, companies in LA, New York, and China, and all over the place. But we're not investing in North Dakota. And so there's conversation about how can we make sure that we're putting these dollars to work for us. You know, a lot of the conversations in the public sphere have been around, you know, what should we do with the earnings coming off of the fund? Maybe we can, you know, pull money straight out and go into buying up school buildings or whatever else across the state. But when we're looking at our current asset allocation and managing our portfolio, we have the chance to take some of the funds that's currently within there and invest them and get market returns by investing in our North Dakota companies and investing in our North Dakota municipalities and the infrastructure projects there to help roll over money. Insurance Commissioner John Gottfried's bringing a proposal before the State Investment Board. He brought it last week at their last meeting to look at creating this kind of legacy fund advisory committee that's looking at investing in North Dakota, generating market returns, and really helping to leverage those dollars to bring more capital to help our North Dakota businesses grow. And I think the time is right to do that. You know, we've been having the conversation for a while, and we know that we've historically had issues for our North Dakota businesses getting access to capital and private equity money. And I think this is a chance where we can really step up as a state and create a win-win situation for our citizens.
I got a blizzard of mail back before the primary because the treasurer's race was contested, pitting some factions of the state Republican Party. Kevin Cramer, for example, versus Doug Burgum. Kevin Cramer backed your opponent, Dan Johnston. Burgum backed you. So were you surprised by that? And might that affect the job if you win the job?
Well, I was absolutely surprised by that. Jumping into this, you know, this is a sixth on the ballot race. It's really a low-profile one. You know, there's only 7 employees total in the treasurer's office. It doesn't usually get this level of attention. But, you know, we have a large party, a big tent party in the North Dakota Republican caucus. And so we have a lot of different factions at play. You know, I was honored to have the support of Governor Burgum, and obviously that got a lot of the attentions in the headlines. But I've got a wide base of support, whether it's, former Governor Jack Dalrymple, Senator John Hoeven, Congressman Armstrong, Attorney General Stengem, the business leaders at the North Dakota Chamber of Commerce, or even the teachers and educators over at North Dakota United have all come back and supported my campaign, whether in the primary or now, and I'm honored to have that really wide base of support all across North Dakota. You know, when we were going through and the COVID situation impacted and canceled all of our conventions, so we needed to collect signatures to get on the ballot. We needed 300 to hit it. Within a matter of a few days, we had over 700 signatures collected, far more than any other candidate running across North Dakota. And so I've really been humbled by the widespread support. And as I've told people in the primary and as I tell them now, if I'm honored to be elected treasurer, you know, I'll be the treasurer for all of North Dakota, right? Whether it's from the far right faction of the Republican Party or the moderate faction, whether you're Republican or Democrat or somewhere in between, you know, the treasurer's office serves our whole state. And so I'm committed to doing that and doing so in a fair and practical manner, in a way that's data driven and not really beholden to any particular dogma, but rather that's looking for good practical solutions for our citizens to help leave North Dakota in a better spot.
An intriguing footnote to this race is that your opponent, Mark Haugen, who's the Democratic NPL candidate, is the grandson of one of the state's NPL leaders who helped forge the connection between the Nonpartisan League and the Democrats in the late 40s. And your grandfather is Earl Strendon. How would you contrast your approach to the job with your opponent, with Mark Haugen?
Well, yeah, and I've been blessed to have a strong family and a great lineage, and my grandfather has been supportive throughout this whole campaign. He told me a couple weeks ago, "Well, Thomas, I can come out either for you or against you. You just let me know what's going to help you out the most." And so I appreciate that, and I appreciate that support. You know, my background as a real estate broker, helping my clients invest tens of millions of dollars in projects all across North Dakota, gives me an experience and a reputation and an understanding of what it means to have a fiduciary responsibility to someone else. My experience in the Legislative Assembly has taught me how to bring coalitions together, work for the common good, has given me experience investing in our infrastructure, investing in our people and our education. And I want to bring that whole background and that wealth of knowledge to the treasurer's office because first and foremost, the job of the treasurer is to be a good steward of taxpayer resources and making sure that all the checks are paid, the lights stay on, and that we're doing it in a detailed and efficient way. I think I've got a large depth and breadth of experience that I can bring to the table there in order to make sure that I can hit the ground running. My experience as a budgeter and appropriator means that I don't really have to learn on the job. And in a time of economic uncertainty, in a time where our revenue is taking a hit over everything that's happened over the last few months, you know, I think that's critically important to do. But more importantly, know, we need to make sure that the next treasurer is committed to providing transparency for how all of your tax dollars are being spent. Because only by providing transparency, and that doesn't just mean putting it out there, but making sure that all of the information about our state budget is easily digestible for the citizens, only by having that transparency can we empower the citizens of North Dakota to hold agencies accountable for how they're spending your money. And so I think that's critically important. That's going to be my number one focus area. But number two, we need to make sure that we're protecting our state going forward, not just with the investments we have, over $24 billion in a variety of funds that's out there, but also recognizing there's bad actors out there that are trying to go after our state. You know, last legislative session, I chaired the conference committee budget for the IT department. And one of the things that we discovered is that there's over 5.3 million cyber attacks on our state systems every month. We need to make sure that we're doing what we can to commit and focus on technology and making sure that we're protecting our taxpayers, not just for the individual day-to-day transactions, not just for the large investment funds that are out there and making sure that we don't have anyone getting access to these funds that shouldn't, but also making sure that all of our citizens' information is being protected so that their vital information, whether it's social security numbers or physical addresses or health records, anything within state government, we need to make sure that that's being protected. And the treasurer's office, because of their role in cutting the checks and getting all that stuff out there, needs to have a seat at the table to make sure that we're committed and focused on, you know, that cybersecurity and protecting our citizens. So my background, you know, my knowledge and the base of experience I have is what I think separates me from my opponent and allows me to hit the ground running and really focus on, you know, leaving the wood pile higher for our citizens, making sure that we leave things better off than we found them, and continue to do good things for our state moving forward.
Thomas Beadle is the Republican candidate for North Dakota Treasurer. You can find out more about his campaign at thomasbeadle.com. Thomas, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Doug. I appreciate it.
Next on Main Street, Sue Balcom and Main Street Eats.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, protecting families from fraud and scams, and helping more than 62,000 family caregivers who help make it possible for their loved ones to live at home, creating real possibilities in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg, and because it's that time of week, it's time to talk with Sue Balcom.
Sue, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. The pleasure is all mine.
Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, to talk about food. And this is a great time of year to talk about squash and pumpkins and where they've been all summer.
It's so funny, too. I don't know what it was. You know, we increased their garden twofold. And so early in the spring, I'm planting potatoes, and then I'm planting cabbage, put in some carrots. I had this great big space left in my garden, so I started filling that in with pumpkin and squash seeds. And I don't know what I was thinking, because I'm like, oh, there's some bare ground over there. Plunk down another plant. Oh, there's some bare ground over there. Plunk in another seed. We couldn't walk through our garden. We couldn't walk through our garden all summer long. The leaves were enormous, and it went out. It spread out around the outside of the garden where we're supposed to be mowing down the grass. So we lost our easement between the garden and the fence, and with all this urban sprawl, you know. So, oh my gosh! So after the frost, and of course we had a hard freeze early in September. That was like a shocker to us farmer market people. We're like scurrying one day to try and harvest as much stuff as we possibly can. But then the joy of this all is those leaves died. And I'm like, oh, look at the pumpkins. Mm. Look at the squash. I had no idea what was going on under there until this big reveal when the frost happened. And so we're going to have pumpkins for all the grandkids. I've got some mini pumpkins to sell at the market. But I have these blue Hubbard squash.
Whoa.
When you buy a can of pumpkin at the store to make a pumpkin pie, you're probably getting a blue Hubbard squash instead. And these things are like giant blue whales swimming around the garden.
Well, that's the thing about squash and pumpkins. They are very prolific. I mean, that's like bounty on top of bounty when you're talking about stuff you can grow.
Like, remember old Mother Hubbard? I think she could have lived in a Blue Hubbard squash instead of a shoe. Because I don't know what I'm going to do. And when you do, you know, after the frost, they lay outside and they kind of cure in the sun. I roll them over and let them cure on the underside. Because you'll want to pick a squash that has a really hard skin. But holy cow, I don't know how we're going to get a butcher knife through these. I think I'm going to have to drop one off the roof and let it bust on the sidewalk in order to harvest it. So they are, winter squash are great. And winter squash are great for keeping in your house in someplace cool away from rodents. And you can have squash like that all winter long. That's why I think the natives grew them out here and my ancestors grew them. Because squash is really, really good for you. Yellow, I mean, really orange colored squash has beta carotene in it, just like carrots. Really, really good for your skin and your eyes.
So when you harvest the squash, do you harvest them ripe or can they ripen after harvest?
Once that frost happens and they're outdoors and cured for a week, maybe even less than a week, go out there and sever them from their umbilical cords and bring them into the house and they will further ripen. Now, I've had some that probably haven't properly cured. They'll get moldy. So you'll want to, just like with anything else in your root cellar, you just don't pile it up and let it go expecting it to survive. You know, potatoes, squash, whatever, apples, you want to lay them in a single layer and kind of go down and remove anything that looks like it's maybe getting soft or moldy, because that puts off that gas that will say to the rest of your produce down there, yeah, it's time to get rotten, kiddos. You don't want that. So you want to make sure that you're down there caring and keeping for your hard-earned produce, and it will reward you all winter long.
Yeah, they keep for months. I mean, almost the whole winter. As long as you're not shoving them all in one pile. They like that single layer.
Taking care of them. And then, of course, you know, like when we have Easter dinner, we usually use the last of our carrots and onions and potatoes for Easter dinner in the spring. So there is a way to keep this.
So if you go down to Sue's root cellar, note how I emphasize that, and you take a big Blue Hubbard squash, how do you prepare it? I mean, do you end up eating it with lots of butter or some maple syrup, or what do you do with it?
Okay, so I have a couple of really awesome things we do with squash. The first and foremost is the pumpkin pie at Thanksgiving, of course. And with a squash this big, you're going to have to probably process a little bit of it. Do not can squash. You cannot even pressure can squash. It's too dense. But you can cut those squash up, bake them in the oven until they're soft. Remove the seeds, of course. You can save the seeds and do art projects with them or make them to eat. Salty, you know, squash seeds are just like salty pumpkin seeds. But you soften that up and scrape it out, and you can puree it with your brand new Braun extra heavy duty 500 watt stick blender that I just got in the mail last week and put that in freezer bags and put it in your freezer. Measure it out into recipe sizes. Like if you need 3 or 4 cups for a couple pies, you want to measure that out ahead of time. And then I thawed out in a colander, so a little bit of that extra water runs out. You can use it like that. But, oh my gosh, if you can get your hands on a smaller squash than a Blue Hubbard, like a butternut or something like that, cut it. Uncle David's dessert squash is what I raise, and they're kind of a small green one. But you cut those in half around the equator, and then you scoop out the seeds, and you take like chorizo sausage and some sourdough bread cubes and some onion and stuff that and bake it right side up. And then you eat the squash with the stuffing. And oh my gosh, it is, that is one of my favorites.
That sounds great.
Oh, it is so good. There's something about that pork sausage and that squash combination that is just really compatible. And I don't like sweet. My husband and I have to make two different pans of squash because he likes brown sugar and butter on his. I like butter and salt and pepper on mine.
Mm.
So those are the two, you know, traditional cut it in cubes, bake it in the oven kind of thing.
Yeah.
For
I like mine with blue cheese, but I also like maple
that would
syrup.
Be good.
So.
I'll go there.
Yes.
I'll go there. Yeah.
Yes. And there's a woman, one of the my son's in-laws or grandfather, grandmother's date or something would bring this squash dish to Thanksgiving.
The things
Sorry,
we're discovering
was,
about your family.
I was trying, like, how do I explain this that her grandpa,
you need
his
a chalkboard.
Grandpa
yeah.
Carol yeah. is dating Carol, and she'd bring this squash dish with maple syrup and nuts on the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And we still haven't gotten that recipe from her yet. And we have to because that is a delightful
Well, you often remind us that the stuff that you grow in your garden, including squash, has health benefits.
Yes. And like I said before, anytime you're eating a winter squash, see, the difference is, you know, winter squashes are the hard-shelled ones. Summer squashes are zucchini, which is a dirty word where I come from, because we have zucchini the size of Ashley right now in our garage, and we don't know what to do with them. Oh my God. I'm not kidding you. They were under the squash leaves and we couldn't find them.
Oh,
and now they're like, so they won't last. Your summer squash won't store well. And while they have vitamins and stuff, anything that you have with that beautiful, rich orange color is going to be really healthy for you. Vitamin C, beta carotenes, antioxidants. It's the sugar that'll kill you. So you got to, like, not put so much sugar on your squash and try it, you know, and squash soup. Oh, squash and apple soup this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
That is so wonderful. There's a bazillion different recipes. Yes, and you can find a recipe that's just simply butter and onions and squash and apples and chicken stock. And there are some that have spices in them. You know, squash goes good with cinnamon and nutmeg and cardamom and things like that. And then you stir a little sour cream in that soup and you'll hear your husband say, if someone had told me 5 years ago that I'd be eating squash soup, I'd have told them they were nuts, but it's one of his favorites. It's awesome.
And there's a lot of good vitamin C in there. It can even be a little bit of a metabolism helper.
Well, anything, you know, that's rich and thick that doesn't have a lot of sugar in it and or flour that turns to sugar is definitely more satisfying to eat than something that has more empty calories
gotcha.
In it. So definitely. And squash is something that, you know, a lot of people are like, I don't know what to do with this. I don't know why I'd want to eat that. But when I made it 1 year for Thanksgiving and had my all the relatives out, they took the leftovers home with them. Their kids took the leftover squash home with them because they loved it so much.
Mm.
We could call squash sort of the North Dakota Mediterranean diet supplement because you know, when I think of the Mediterranean diet, that's a lot of vegetables and fish and stuff like that. Well, squash seems to fit that niche a bit in terms of being good for you and being bountiful as well.
Right. So lock your cars, people. I still have all that zucchini in my garage.
Yeah. When my doorbell rings, I check that camera on the doorbell. Yeah.
Zucchini gram.
Yes.
It's you know,
it's not a Louisville slugger. It's a squash.
I kid you not. We have a wheelbarrow full of zucchini and about, I'd say 15 enormous pumpkins, which don't forget that a pumpkin is still from the cucurbit family. And that also has all the health benefits in. So if you are not carving them up for Halloween, you most certainly can substitute a pumpkin for squash and your family will never know the difference.
All right. We check in with Sue Balcom for Main Street Eats every week. Always a pleasure, Sue.
Oh, thank you, guys. It was great.
Decoded Eight Book is next.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 1st. It was on this date in 1961 that a shy baseball player from Fargo stunned the sports world in one of the most anticipated games ever played. Roger Maris hit his 61st home run, breaking the record set by Babe Ruth for the most home runs in one season. Maris came to the Yankees on a trade after the 1959 season. He did well. In 1960, he hit 39 home runs and led the league in RBIs. He won a Gold Glove and the American League's Most Valuable Player Award. But it was the following year that Maris became a household name, when he and teammate Mickey Mantle each looked like they had a shot at beating Babe Ruth's record. Mantle enjoyed the focus and became a media darling. But Maris was uncomfortable with the limelight. When an injury took Mantle out of the running, Maris was left alone in the spotlight, and he struggled with the attention. The Babe was a legend for Yankees fans, and many openly rooted against Maris, even though he too was a Yankee. But he continued hitting home runs, with his record-breaking 61st happening on the final day of the season. In a 1998 article, writer John Young recounted a personal memory of the event when his dad took him to see the Yankees on that fateful October 1st. John's birthday. Being a young child, he had trouble seeing Roger Maris when he came to bat because everyone in the bleachers around them stood in anticipation. John didn't see it, but during Roger's second at bat, he knew by the crack of the bat and the reaction of the crowd that the Babe's record was breaking. The crowd squeezed in around him, shoving and pushing, with his dad in the very center. Arms were flying, pulling, and tugging. Policemen converged from three directions and gradually pulled apart the mass. As the chaos came to an end and John's dad returned to his seat, he presented John with the baseball. Years later, shortly before his death, John's dad told him, "We saw a man become a hero that day." Maris's home run record stood for 37 years before Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa both broke it in 1998. Fans today continue to lobby for the induction of Roger Maris into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It was business as usual for airlines until last spring.
No flights, nobody was flying. I mean, I remember going to the airport and it was like a ghost town.
Now with air travel still down 70%, tens of thousands of workers are wondering what to do next.
I don't have a college degree. I don't have any formal official training. This is all I've ever known.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you know, when we broadcast, we also stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Friday on Main Street, we'll hold our monthly journalist roundtable with Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson and special guests KFYR-TV reporter Jacob Noderman and Renee Jean, Assistant Managing Editor of the Williston Herald. And Madeline will review The Cave of the Yellow Dog. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.